Welcome to the Bumblecast. I'm your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always is my co-host with the co-most, Kyle Krause.
Ho-ho! Ho-ho! That's not overdone.
No, I'm not scraping to the bottom of the barrel looking for ideas. No, sir.
No. We certainly don't do that on this show.
No, we don't fly by the seat of our pants either.
No, we don't. No, we don't. Because we're not wearing any pants.
Whoa! Anyway. But you know what? That offers up a wonderfully awkward segue into the big announcement we have for this show. Are you out there listening to the Bumblecast thinking to yourself, I'm cold. I wish I had something to wear. I wish I had something to wear that had the Bumblecast logo on it. I really like Ian and Kyle, but I don't want to give money through Patreon. I want to support them some other way. Well, do we have an item for you? Many items, actually. We are now announcing the opening of the Bumble Store.
Man, we're getting a lot of mileage out of tacking Bumble in the front of everything, that's for sure.
Oh, we are driving this sucker into the ground.
Yes, yes, I love it.
You can go over to BumbleKing.com, check it out. We've got a number of items that are all customizable. Hoodies, t-shirts, the whole plethora of what the shop creates. Head over to BumbleKing.com or Spreadshirt.com/BumbleStore. They provide all of the items. We have a few of the logos that you can place pretty much anywhere on any of those items, resize how you want. It isn't one of those, you know, custom, just slap it on there and go. You can actually pick a lot of colors and do a lot of refinement if you want it your way. And every sale gets a little bit of that going back to us, and that helps us out a bunch.
Yes, indeed. You can even get yourself a trucker hat if you want to be properly outfitted for our American Truck Simulator playthroughs.
Yeah, wear that. Watch us drive a truck.
Yeah.
Make Bumblecast great again.
Wow, that's the most political we've ever gotten on this show, I think.
And that's as far as we're going to go.
Yes, indeed.
So please do, if you have a couple bucks and you want to see me just light up if you ever show up at a con wearing something Bumble related, I will probably cry a little bit because I'm that big of a softie.
do it now.
But that's enough of trying to make you buy things. Let's give something to one of our listeners. It's time for the Bumble Raffle.
Yeah.
Every show we hold a contest where we randomly select either someone from the patron or someone who writes in. Patrons are automatically entered into every drawing, but you can always write in per episode to see if you win. And this episode's winner is...
Rika!
Who is our second non-patron to win the Bumble Raffle. Congratulations.
Very nice, very nice.
What are the odds?
We do give things to other people.
I'm actually curious what the odds are, because I have no idea how to do statistics. I am a math failure.
Yes, yes. Is this our first overseas listener? Our overseas winner?
No. We've actually had a few from the UK.
Okay. I did not know that. Very cool.
So, congratulations, Rika. We will get in contact with you to find out where we're sending you your free autographed book.
Very cool.
And before we move into our special segment for today, Kyle, what have you been up to?
Well, I just managed to catch Logan this past weekend as we're recording this. The new and quote-unquote final Wolverine movie.
We'll see if that sticks, but
yeah. And it's intense. That's really the best way I can describe it, in a good way. I'm not gonna spoil it for you, because you really do need to see this. I hesitate to immediately call it the best superhero movie, but it's definitely way up there. It is strangely, X-Men movies tend to be pretty silly. I mean, the source material is pretty silly, but yeah. this is dark, gritty, serious, and dark, gritty, and serious done well, unlike the other dark, gritty, and serious, quote-unquote serious movie we had last year from the DC camp that we will not
really
name.
Need to stop harping on that one.
Why? It was bad. I mean,
it's not sporting to kick it while it's down, you know?
You know what? I don't care. It made a crap load of money. It made a crap ton of money. And it's bad. They can handle it. They're a big studio. It's good. Anyway, yeah, this is definitely Fox's best output for superhero movies, bar none. So, yeah, go see it. I won't spoil anything for you, but it's very good. I really just don't. I don't want to delve into it. I want to delve into it, but I don't because I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to ruin it. But I do I do like that they have introduced X-23, who's probably, she's one of my favorite X-Men for sure. So yes, and her portrayal is perfect. It's very good. So go see it, Ian, and everybody else, go see it.
I will. Kind of on the same topic of I want to talk about it all the time, but can't because it's still really new and pretty much everything in it is a spoiler, is Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Ah, yes.
Which is, in my humble opinion, nigh upon perfect. It is exactly what I wanted, and it keeps surprising me and delivering in ways I didn't even know I wanted. I have logged, at this point, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, 40 hours.
Oh, wow.
Into the game.
Man, you have a lot of time.
I'm between projects at the moment.
Yes.
But, and that may be a low estimate, high estimate, I don't know, I haven't been paying attention because I've been playing this game. I have not touched any of the main quests aside from kind of getting the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. I have been just exploring, finding things, doing things, completing small objectives, dying in horrible ways. It's a game that does the open world right in that there's always something to do, but it doesn't feel like a fetch quest.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the later Assassin's Creeds got really tiresome because it's, you find the tower, it gives you the items to find, you go to the items, you pick them up. There's no exploration. It's just, here are the things to do.
Yeah.
Breath of the Wild is, you find the towers, but all that does is give you points of reference on a better map. It's still up to you to find things. You find something, you don't know what to do with it yet, you mark it on the map, you can come back to it later. You see something on the horizon, you go, what is that? You go and find it, and you find more things. Something comes around the corner, you go, what is that? It kills you. You come back to fight it again. It should be called Legend of Zelda, What Is That? Because that's the entire game.
That's like Zelda 1.
Yes, exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's not, go to this temple, get the key item that will solve the puzzles in this temple, beat the boss, repeat. Which is fine. Those worked great. Ocarina of Time set that model, and it revolutionized the series and set the bar for all the types of games like it to come. But it's kind of become stale.
Yeah.
This is going straight back to the original, and I really don't know if I want to go back to the Ocarina of Time model now, because Breath of the Wild is just so fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, corridors of big temples, it's lots of little temples, so you feel you're still challenged, but it's nice little bite-sized nuggets, and you move on. Okay, I'm going to go on forever. We're keeping our guests waiting. That's right. We have someone who has bought their way back onto the Bumblecast. So, please welcome Harlan to the show.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I paid internet money.
And we are so happy you did.
You're very welcome.
The good thing about internet money, it's just as good as real money.
Let's hope so.
I don't know, though. You have some internet bucks.
As long as it's not Bitcoin.
Well, Bitcoin works. It's just tough to use. Oh. Anyway.
That's a whole other show.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah. Let's not turn this into cryptocurrency hour.
So, Harlan, tell the kind listeners to the Bumcast just a little bit about yourself, what it was that decided to use your well-earned money to earn a spot on the show.
Oh, my well-earned burger flipping money?
Hey, a job's a job.
Hey, man, you flip burgers, I've fried chicken. It don't matter. It pays the bills.
Yep.
It does. No, I've been a fan of you for a decent amount. I was a fan of Sonic first, of course. I was just like, you know what? I want to hang out with Ian Flynn for a while. And now here we are.
And here we are.
Wasn't too complicated. Now, Ian, I do have a question. I do have a major question, though.
Okay.
And this is important. Because you are the writer of the Sonic comic book, can you canonize the fact that 06 is the best game? Can you do that? Can you do that for me here?
I will give it major brownie points in the fact that through its own canon, it makes itself not exist.
Why do you hurt me?
It's the...
All right. Let's actually give some credit here to 06, because everybody rags on the game, and for good reason. But let's highlight the good stuff, like playable Blaze. That there aren't too many games with playable Blaze.
That's Sonic true. Rush, which is a better game.
Yes, and the only instance of 3D playable Blaze. So give it points for that, even if she was like grease on a mirror. It gave us Silver, who is absolutely adorable. Sorry, say again.
No, I was saying you also play Blaze for about 5 seconds.
Yeah.
What was rendered looked really pretty. The music is fantastic. It may not be traditional Sonic-y, but I really dig the whole soundtrack.
The soundtrack was one of the few things they put effort into. One of the few things that wasn't fair. One of the few things that wasn't rushed, I should say, because they put effort into it, but obviously it was very rushed.
Why do you hurt me, Kyle?
Because. Why do you hurt yourself by defending Sonic 06?
Why did I do this? I'm just gonna go. Tomorrow, I'm just gonna look at my roommate and I'm saying I paid money to just get beat up by Ian Flynn. And his friend Kyle.
Ian Flynn's flunky over here. Yeah.
This is a good day.
Yes.
This is a good day.
I will always be bitter, though, because they data mined 06 and they found that there was going to be a playable Metal Sonic.
Oh, and really?
I would pay a pretty penny to see 06 styled Metal Sonic.
Now, I actually did not know this, even though I'm five of the three people who like 06. I actually did not know this. Was it just for like a multiplayer thing that never worked out, or was there like a camp, or like was it like a side character, or like a campaign? I assume not a campaign, but was it like a Tails or Knuckles-esque side character?
Because when they data mined the assets, they found a lot of entries, but not necessarily how they would be implemented.
Right.
Like some of the things included were playable Supersonic in the regular stages. They actually found the transformation animation for it.
Oh, cool.
So Sonic kind of jumps in the air. The spines go up. He looks like he's about to Super Saiyan, and then he just drops back to his feet. The entire sound library from the previous... Sorry, soundtrack library from the games. Previous games were all going to be unlockables. I think there was supposed to be a more robust Amigo character system, since Knuckles had his own special... end stage animation in lines depending on the different grade levels. So assuming all the other characters had them too, if you could figure out a way to trigger them.
Right.
So 06 really looked like it was supposed to be this huge game and they just ran out of time.
Why do you hurt me, Sega?
Yeah, they had a...
sharing the news with you.
They clearly had a lot of grand plans for the game that just never came to fruition because they tried to rush it for a holiday release.
And they split the dev team because they were also working on, I think it was Secret Rings at the time.
Yeah.
No. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, I mean, that makes sense because Secret Rings is, I mean, maybe not so much gameplay, but story-wise, it always felt like the same basic tonal beats and themes and sort of like, here's the 06 for, you know, if you can't afford 06 because you only have a Wii, you know, like it was clearly like, it's clearly a companion piece.
Mm-hmm. And as much as I love Secret Rings' soundtrack, God, the controls. I would dare say 06 is more playable than Secret Rings straight out of the box.
Well, obviously it's more playable because it's the best one. So, I will say, Eraser Jin has the greatest theme song of all time. Sometimes I just play it and I just feel good about life. His theme song is incredible.
All right, so when you emailed saying you wanted to be on the show, You said you had just some general questions you wanted to hawk out there. So let's get to it before we get to the regular Q&A session.
I get all the questions and all of the A's. All of them, the mine. No, I did have a few, because here's the thing. And I'm glad I sort of nabbed this opportunity up, because I am by no means professional, but I do fancy myself a writerist at times. And I kind of write screenplays mostly for myself, but I send them out and then people say no. But we creatively, we are very different. And that interests me a lot for a lot of different reasons. And I've always had things I've wondered about, how a writer like you would handle or how you handle or go about handling certain things. Some of these may be loaded with certain assumptions, and feel free to correct me if that comes up. But I do have a few things I've always kind of wondered. Because one thing I do admire about, and when I say writer like you, I mean, like you tend to work in like tie-in stuff, and you have your own original properties here and there, but you tend to be a tie-in writer, and you're very good at sort of finding the core nugget of what makes a property tick. Like Mega Man is wonderful. Mega Man is wonderful. Especially Ra Moon, which is my favorite thing of all time. And I have a question about Ra Moon. So hopefully we'll get to that. But the first question I have, and if I word this stupidly, I'll try and correct it. but one thing, again, I admire is that you seem to be able to hit the tone of the property you're writing and sort of make it, obviously some stories will always be better than others, but you're very good at harnessing, like, you know, like, this is what's appealing. I know how to spin this, da da da. Fans, however, often have a very, very different idea of what makes a particular property worth appealing to. I know this because of endless internet posts of people asking me, what am I talking about when I say why I like Sonic? What I'm wondering is, how do you find the balance between your own particular voice? Because you're approaching it from a point of view. I may not always be conscious of what that point of view is as you're writing, but it has to bleed in there in some respect, I assume.
Sure.
And how do you find the balance between what that is and not necessarily what fans want, but maybe giving them, how do I word this, what they mean when they say what they want? Because the big example I always kind of draw to is, not naming any names, of course, but there are plenty of fans out there who, you look at the game writing, for example, they say, you know, we want the game writing to not be so comedy, blah, 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 and more in the, you know, dramatic depth of Sonic Adventure 2. Whereas I look at Sonic Adventure 2, and all I see is, like, weird plot and thematic holes. And I always wonder, do they want Sonic Adventure 2 again, or do they want what they remember Sonic Adventure 2 being? And that's just a random example. Yeah. I'm not trying to tie anyone's answer to that. So my question is, do you factor in, like, do you try to factor in approximating what fans want, or do you try and kind of, like, chart the course between skill and prejudice and try to figure out what they may, quote-unquote, mean when they say what they want? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's a really tricky balancing act. With licensed properties, especially, because not only is it a matter of writing for the fans, but you have to write within what the licensor wants as well. And what the licensor wants and what the fans want, or what the fans think they want, as you said, may not all meet in the middle sometimes. With Mega Man specifically, I did a lot of research on the games first. You know, how did they play? How did the art style evolve? What were the nuances in the Japanese material that was lost or changed when it came over to the Western interpretations? What are the fans' reactions to all those? And what is my personal take from it? What do I enjoy out of Mega Man? And there isn't really a dedicated process I have. There's not like a checklist of this is what you do in order to rationalize it. It was more of a matter of researching it and kind of distilling it in my own mind, which sounds really bloody pretentious, but
you're in good company.
It's just a matter of trying to find out what I think would be the happy medium You know, ultimately, with a licensed book, you have to have the licensor's happiness come first, because they're the ones who are going to be approving what you put out, and they're the ones who can pull the license at any time if they don't like it. That being said, Capcom was great to work with on the writing side of things. I didn't really know much about the art, because obviously I didn't do any of the art, but they were very receptive to the liberties I took with the story and how I was able to integrate stuff like Time Man and Oil Man. When I pitched the Ra Moon arc, I was honestly surprised that we were allowed to do it, given that Ra Moon's game was Japanese exclusive. And the one that I was most surprised about was in the final issue before the hiatus, we got a page that was dedicated to the Elf Wars, which has not had any art dedicated that I'm aware of, and is a semi-nebulous part of the canon, and they allowed us to basically create that. So I'm very thankful for that much, but I'm getting off topic.
It's all very interesting.
Well, no, at the same time, see, that kind of falls into it too, because the Elf Wars is that kind of nebulous space between X and Zero, and I know there's a lot of fans who would want to see that. So having that one page dedicated was, you know, my push in what was potentially against the licensor's idea to do something for the fans that they would enjoy. At the same time, I wouldn't feel comfortable, you know, devoting an entire story arc of Mega Man just to the Elf Wars for the sake of fan service, because they want to see the classic story advance. I know a lot of people are not happy that we didn't get all the way to 4, and drives me nuts too, because, oh, I had plans for Mega Man 4.
In that defense, though, I still think that Red and Blue Ship were pretty perfect endings, honestly.
They came together very well, I think, and I know that everyone involved really poured their heart into it. If and when Mega Man comes back, and before people start sending in the questions on that, I don't know. That's above me. But I know that everyone wants it back. So if and when it comes back, you know, we wanted to leave ourselves room to pick it up again. But at the same time, if things fell through, give it a nice note to end on.
Sure. Which, on that subject, Mega Man as a comic really fascinated me, because I'm actually not a huge Mega Man guy. I played some of the classic games. I loved X as a kid, like the gameplay. I still think the story is nonsense, but I loved the gameplay. Like, oh, that was just fun. I played a little bit of 4, and that was cool. I like that story a little more until I like the individual scenes. When you try and put it all together, it's like, what? But like, my main exposure to Mega Man was mostly the NT Warrior, the dub of, you know, the Battle Network anime. Okay. That was sort of like my main exposure to Mega Man as a kid. Like, I played the others, but as I was growing up, like, that was sort of, which I always thought Battle Network was funny, because I knew the entire root of Mega Man's character is he's a pacifist, and they're like, what if we made a version of Mega Man where he just liked killing things, but it was like friendly. And it worked. They got like 7,000 games out of it, so what do I know? But so I was never a huge Mega Man guy, but I had given it a shot largely because your name was on it. And I was like, all right, why not? And I love that comic. But here's the thing about, I don't mean this as an insult, which, you know, something horrible is about to come out of my mouth.
Yeah, you can feel the shoe about to drop.
And I, oh God, this is a horrible decision. No, but, oh, this is so. No, it's weird because Mega Man as a comic, it has a somewhat literal way it goes about adapting the game storylines. Like Mega Man actually jumps boss to boss to boss, like in the games. And there's a part, and I don't know why my brain is like this, because I like so many baby things, so you think it wouldn't be, but I tend to have a very, I tend to like more surreal or abstract stuff most of the time, but I also like kids' cartoons for some reason. But so, like, in theory, I should have, like, picked Mega Man up and just thrown it just away. Just no. But it has weird, like, the emotional logic was very strong. And I think that kept me in, because, of course, all the Robot Masters were very well characterized. But I think the thing that clinched my love for the comic was the Curse of Ra Moon, or that whole Ra Moon section. Like, the rest I enjoy very much. But especially Quake Woman. Quake Woman is wonderful.
Wake Woman's, I think, the she best was my, part of the book.
She really is. She was my favorite character.
Yep.
But I used to, I don't know, back on Bumble King, I used to describe Ra Moon as like the best version of every shonen anime filler arc ever. because those were the only parts of this anime that I really liked, because those were the, because on one level they were the easiest to watch because they actually felt written for TV. Like Frieza wasn't flying around for 10 minutes, just doing whatever, just hanging out. Like they actually felt paced for TV, but also there was this fascinating creative challenge where like they knew they had more comic to adapt when they were done. So it's like, how do they write like 30, 40 something episodes, but invalidate nothing? So just the craziest crap would just fly out. And that's how I feel about Ra Moon. Cause it's like, this comic is like, hey, do robots have feelings? By the way, there's a space god and he's a robot. And I'm like, what? And I keep reading and it's just wonderful. But it's the thing that gets me is that on one level, I'm not quite sure how much like practical plot logic sense it makes. Because of course, like, I think there's a line that addresses it, but of course, the comic, and again, I don't think this is a fault, the comic really breezes over the fact that there's a giant like robot deity just kind of hanging out. He's been in here since ancient times, just chilling, being his evil self. And it doesn't seem to factor into the whole robot sentience debate that much, which is fine, because it really shouldn't, because that's just a whole can of worms that would derail the entire comic. But at the same time, it's also sort of the best story because it has a lot of the best dramatic moments. The scale is, it's a huge scale, but it doesn't necessarily break any of the characters involved. I was just curious. Or you can just punch me in the face if any part of this was just insulting. But when it came to adapting Ra Moon, because I've always sort of assumed the reason, because I don't know if I misread this or misremember this or if I read it correctly, but the game takes place, like the only logical place it would take place was like between 2 and 3 or something. So you were like, if I'm going to adapt it, it has to be here. But I guess my question is like, on a practical level, it should, or at least sort of kind, like it kind of shatters the entire like world building of the comic, but emotionally it tracks so well that most people didn't, like, I never care about world building, so I didn't care, but I noticed most people didn't seem to mind. So I was wondering with the Ra Moon stuff, how much did you consider the giant robot space devil in your comic about cute robots trying to figure out if they have feeling? And did you concern yourself too much with how it was supposed to fit or not fit, or did you sort of let the emotions ride it and just carry it through?
The thing with Ra Moon is it was kind of like taking a square peg and fitting it into a round hole.
Yes.
Because the Mega Man 2 and 3 Robot Masters show up in a fashion that it doesn't neatly fit anywhere. Right. One of the problems, too, is that Beat shows up in the game, and Beat doesn't show up until after Mega Man 4, because he was a gift from Dr. Cossack for helping him in Mega Man 4. So there was a degree of, okay, this is just going to have to be comic continuity version, because it ain't going to work any other way. Another reason I wanted to do it was strictly to do it. You know, I wanted to climb that mountain. And the third reason was because it set up more of the space stuff that comes later on. Like you said, you're not a big Mega Man guy, so some of the things that would have come down the line are the Star Droids.
Yeah, that's another thing, because that felt like something, and again, like that felt like something that should have bugged me, because the comic conditions you sort of like, here's, you know, it's humanity has discovered artificial intelligence, we're reaching that point, and then one robot's just like, I was in a space army once, isn't that weird? Like, that should have bugged me. Like, that should have, I'm just like, I should have been like, what is this? This is the most ridiculous. And I read it, I'm like, this is the coolest thing.
I think when you boil it down, it comes down to the sincerity of the characters.
Yes.
I think, and this goes beyond Mega Man. I think this goes for anything. It doesn't really matter what setting you have or what the characters are. As long as they take themselves and their world seriously, I think the majority of the audience will become invested in it because the characters are invested in it. I think the core humanity of the characters, their desires are what translate to what we read. So if you have a little blue boy robot who was originally meant to fix cars with faces on them and decides to turn himself into a literal living weapon because somebody made his builder dad sad. That shouldn't be accessible on any level, but the idea of a child wanting to help their father, of someone who wants to do something against the overwhelming problems of the world, the idea of self-sacrifice for the greater good and wanting to believe in somebody that pure, those are all things that we can connect with at a primal level. And I think as long as you can present that in, I hate to say realistic way, because that has too many niggles.
I get what you mean. Like, I get what
you
mean.
As long as you can present it in a convincing way, and as long as the characters are convinced themselves, then I think that does a lot of the legwork. Now, obviously, this goes out the window if you're doing something that's obviously meant to be farcical, because then if the characters don't take the world seriously, the readers don't have to, and they can all laugh together. But that's a completely different topic.
Right, because I think, because again, like that sort of thing, I actually found a lot of the pre-reboot Sonic comic to not necessarily be inaccessible, but it never clicked with me like it did with a lot of Sonic fans. Because, and I think a big part of that was, again, with so much of it was sort of focused on, you know, kind of slowly creating, like, it has a lot of wacky stuff and like neat ideas flowing every which way, but also it's very much like a giant world. Like, it's very much this big mosaic of all these different things. And I was like, I don't care. I'm sorry. What is this? And I'd always sort of liked the Sonic game stories because I hesitate to call them well-written, but there was a lot about them I admired on an emotional level. I had rambled before, well, not on the podcast, obviously, but just on the internet. It was always sort of about, I liked that Sonic was this mythic hero who would run into prophecies that have nothing to do with him, resolve those prophecies by beating the random giant devil of the week, and not ask for anything in return. Just like, oh, I gotta stop the apocalypse. I'm gonna just run. I always found that very endearing, and that core sentiment was always strong enough to sort of carry me through the different game stories. Like, people would get excited about, like, oh, a Geezoid showed up. That's neat. I'm like, I don't care. What's it doing? Is it just there? Whatever. I always liked that the games would, like, it was appealing to me that the tones didn't really, like, the tones and, like, the world it took place in didn't always connect. Because the setting would just change based on the emotional state. And that made sense to me. So in that regard, that's why sort of Ra Moon was my favorite. Like, I can push all the practical questions back pretty easily. I just liked, again, that you were willing to just say, okay, I'm writing this sort of story, but I'm just going to drop this giant thing. Let's just do that. I love that sort of thing. So I really liked that you had tackled that story a lot, because that was definitely one of the big things that when I talk about Mega Man and the comic, you know, I'll talk about how, oh yeah, the characters all feel really well written. Also, there is this great arc with a giant space god monster robot, and it's super, and you should read that, because that's another thing that I do want to ask you now that we're here. I say now that we're here, we've been here for like 30 minutes, but because that's always something I've sort of had frustrations with in almost any fan community I've ever been in, which is I've always noticed that for a lot of fans, the mythology of something tends to take precedence over other things. A story could be clicking emotionally, but they're like, yeah, but Sonic didn't buy those shoes at that time, so it's bad. Sears doesn't exist on Mobius, or does it? So this story is off. And do you have... And I've always sort of, because one thing I liked about the reboot, because I really liked the reboot, the Sonic reboot, I thought was great, think is great. But one thing I've always wondered about it is, I think the one thing I had always wished was kind of pushed back a little more is, and I can understand why you did it, because it's trying to, you know, you have to rebuild an entire setting, and you have to sort of get a new cultural context for that and go, I'm going to make sure everything, blah, blah, blah. And I understand, and that's fine. But there were so many times where I'm wishing, can't Sonic just do this random thing? Can't he just go to some new space world? I'll make it make sense in my head. It's okay. Because, so I was, I do wonder, especially in an all ages property where theoretically the setting doesn't matter too much unless you go on a message board. Do you see world building and mythology construction? Is that something that greatly appeals to you? Do you see it as more of a means to an end? Is it sort of a combination? How is that? And how do you, and again, I guess this sort of dials back into question one, but sort of different, which is how do you try to make the balance between how important it is and how important fans think it is and the lights there and da da da? Like, how does that, how's that run?
For me, I love world building and lore building. I could do that all day, every day, and if that could just be my job, I could write lore for everybody. Come one, come all. I will spin you 700 pages Cimmerillion or whatever you want, because I love that stuff. In terms of what it needs, is it really needed? It's yes and no. For a licensed book like Sonic or for Mega Man, I think it's, you need some foundation to establish the rules of the world so that you have that grounded sense that you can build off of. Like with the Sonic games, they establish that there are other planets with the Wisps, other dimensions with Blaze, time travel with Silver.
Books so, are planets, apparently.
Yeah, there's pocket just dimensions books. Within storybooks, that kind of thing. So as long as you say, okay, that's what's established, and they are equal in these sorts of ways, that you can draw these kinds of parallels, then if you want to expand upon it, if you have the opportunity to do so, you can do it that at least feels thematically in vain, in the same vein with it. If you're doing your own thing, I think it's important to build a lot of that world so that when you introduce your characters to these elements, you're not just flying by the seat of your pants and you have less opportunity to contradict yourself. If you know that this region is of this kind of biome, the culture is generally this, you can find these kinds of animals, then that kind of informs how a background setting would be. Is it an advanced nation? That tells you what the architecture is going to be so that you know that's what the settings would be like, instead of you write character A walks into village. What does that mean? Is it stone huts? Is it skyscrapers? What is the village? Well, if it's constructed from this material, then it means they have this level of technology, which means they have this level of scientific understanding, which means there's this much time has passed. And you don't need that for the immediate narrative, but as the writer, you kind of need it so that you know what your limits are, so that you don't just go crazy with it. It gives you some guidelines. It allows you to color within the lines, so to speak. At the same time, because you are constructing this world, you can do whatever you want. To me, it's like you're setting the rules for a game. You can play it however you want, but it has to be confined within these limitations, because otherwise it's just Calvin Ball, and that is not conducive to a ongoing story or a good metaphor, because I'm really driving this into the ground at this point.
Yeah, it's that makes sense. Because I actually do...
But just to finish off, to tie it into what the fans want, in that regard, I think you kind of have to, let's just stick to the licensed books for this one.
Yeah.
I think you need to stick with what is canon to the licensed material, what the license holder wants, and make as best sense of it as you can, because everyone has their own personal opinion on how things should have played out in game X, Y, or Z, what the themes and deeper meaning were behind this, that, or the other. And there's some folks who find in Sonic 06 very deep meaning and Jesus symbology and
who's that? Who would stuff. That be? Who's that?
I don't know. Some crazy guy. And there's others probably. Who see it as a Final Fantasy wannabe fluff. So there's no happy medium between those two. So if I were to have adapted 06 straight, it would have been within the confines of what the game gave me, make it sense within the greater world that's already been established, and not try to please the various factions within the fan base, because you cannot please the majority there.
Oh, no.
You kind of stick to your guns on that one.
I will say, I would like to point out that Mephiles is named after Mephistopheles, and Iblis is a name from the Quran, because my theories aren't crackpot internet. They're bright. I said it on Bumblecast. Makes it bright. No, but that makes sense. Because I actually do admire that a lot. About, I have a friend, and she is not like super, super like loves the world, but she loves the world build, blah, blah, blah. But she does have a very like fantasy, because she was a big bookworm and she has a very fantasy literary sort of influence in her writing when we try to write back and forth. And she knows that when, if I ever get like a list of how like a mythological dimension works, just like raw data, I'm like, my brain just starts collapsing and melting out of my ears. Like, it's like, what is it? But I do admire her. And in that regard, I do admire the fact, because this is something my brain just does not process on any level. But I do admire the fact that you do sort of take what should, like you say, kind of be inaccessible and ridiculous, and you do give it that sort of coherency that it does feel lived in. I think that's actually a very, that's a strong quality. That's something I admire a lot.
Thank you.
It's not something I always care about as I'm reading. I'm like, because I'm the sort of person who, like, I look at Sonic Colors and I look at Sonic 06, and I'm like, yeah, that could fit together. That makes sense. Those look the same to me. Whatever. So, you know, that's the same. But I do admire that quality. And it's definitely, what's the word I'm looking for? It's something that I won't say I'm jealous of personally, but it's, I do get that sort of thing sometimes where I'll show someone something and they're like, how does this all work? And I'm like, it feels right. Isn't that enough? And it's not. Oh, well.
Well, that's something that you have to be aware of too, is what feels right to you, what makes sense in your mind.
Yeah, clicks. Yeah. That comes up a lot.
Work for everyone else. And I'm guilty of that. Every writer's guilty of that.
Oh yeah.
And you just have to make yourself open to feedback and revision and go, okay, that really, really cool thing that totally made sense doesn't. Redo.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's I admire a lot. That's one thing I admire about Ramune, going back to that, is I do admire when a license, cause there is no way around this. I am a pretentious jerk in every fashion, but I do admire, the sort of property based or all ages based, blah, 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 sort of works that manage to keep this sort of, if not necessarily abstract, like a more personal, somber sort of tone. Like, I'm the sort of person whose favorite Transformers cartoon is Beast Machines, which should probably be the least surprising thing in the world at this point. But but I do love, my only point was I admired the Ramune art for that sort of emotional connectivity and kind of breezing around the practical questions. Because like you said, as long as you invest enough, people usually aren't going to care. And maybe I'm just so cynical at this point, I was surprised people didn't mind as much.
I'm sure if you looked, you would find someone who
I'm sure.
It's the internet, come on.
Yeah, that's... Oh, also, this is completely unrelated, but I love Xander. Can I just say how much I loved how his story ended? I'm sorry, temporarily ended.
Somebody liked Xander Payne? There's a human being who liked Xander Payne?
Dude, I love Xander.
Well, hot diggity, I made somebody happy.
I think I wasn't necessarily huge on... I think his name was a little cheesy. I didn't mind Xander. The Payne last name is always hard to... That's always hard to feel organic with anything, I think. But
well, this is in a world with a Dr. Wily and a Dr. Light, so...
Right, yeah, I mean, like, it's not that it doesn't fit. I'm not saying it doesn't fit. But, no, but I love Xander. I adored how his arc ended. I always wondered... I assumed most of what I thought about it was intentional, but that's gotten me in trouble so many times. I just loved... first, I just liked his shtick. Like, I because it was nice having a villain who wasn't Dr. Wily, who wasn't like, who also wasn't evil scientist. Like, there was actually, like, he had a neat shtick. But I really love how, I actually like the fact we got an X arc more than we had an X series. Because I'm sure if there was an X book, I would have read it and enjoyed it. But X makes no sense, and the story is dumb. So I was open to like a cool version of X, but I wasn't like, I need it. It was the sort of thing where like, if it came up, cool. So I actually liked the X arc more because it was framed, because you framed it in that way where there's that aspect of it. It's sort of like Xander's seeing it out of context and sort of confirming what blah, blah, blah. And it gives him, and, you know, fuels the rest of his character arc. And I thought that was actually pretty clever. And I especially enjoyed, and how intentional is this? I enjoyed the fact that you made him Mr. X. One, because I have no emotional attachment to Mr. X whatsoever. So you could have done anything you wanted. And I'd be like, meet. Because I don't care. But two, I liked that he called himself Mr. X. Because, well, obviously, Mr. X, obviously. But I liked, well, I mean, one, I liked that Mr. X was a future Xander. Because, of course, a bigot will be stuck in the past. like, it literalizes the idea that a bigot is stuck in the past. And I thought that was lovely. But I also liked that he was called Mr. X when the entire, like the person that basically triggered that identity was X, like X's future. And he's sort of, well, how intentional was it? Cause I sort of read it as, and he's not aware, and he's not aware of any of this, or at least in the reading I had, like he's not aware of any of this, but he names himself. He has the same name as the robot that defines the future that confirms what he believes. By giving himself that name and considering himself a man, he's sort of like subconsciously admitting that X is also a person, but he's not aware of it. And he's sort of self-defeatist in his own attempt to recapture himself. Is that a...
There are... Some of that is there. Some of that is a very interesting interpretation, and I love it.
Yay!
Part of Mr. X is that's just the name of the persona Dr. Wily took on in Mega Man.
Right. I know in the game, it was just like a dude, like it was like Wily's disguise or something. Like I knew he was like, right. I knew he was originally Wily.
Right. Yes. And I had, from the get go, I had wanted to put somebody as an original Mr. X because I figured once we got to that part of Mega Man, Dr. Wily being the mastermind behind it all was going to be very, very tired. And him being in a very bad disguise wasn't going to refresh that. And up to that point, there was a very big question of where's Wily getting the funding and the resources to menace anyone and everyone up to that point.
Patreon. And
beyond that. So that's why I wanted to create the Mr. X that would back Wily and be expendable for Wily to take over and yada, yada, yada. And when Xander fell into place because of circumstances, it all fit together fairly neatly. It's kind of where I was going with things. The correlation you have between the Mr. X of the past trying to prevent a future that he sees as negative, whereas X, the character, is the embodiment of robots striving to be more human to also prevent a doomed future, is an interesting parallel that I think the seeds were there, but I think you're making a stronger connection than I initially intended. So cool on you.
I am used to that. Happens all the time. But it was that connection that also made me so happy with the ending. Or I'm sorry, the temporary ending. Possibly. I don't know. Oh God, I'd be horrible at this. Anyway, because I liked that Mega Man and Proto Man were resolved. Like I thought, like it didn't feel like, I mean, obviously it's easy to read that as, and of course it was intended to be read as, here's where we can stop for now, but it's open if we keep going. And of course I saw it as that. But I think by the nature of what the book had gone through, because you had like the anniversary issue, you had the X issue, there was a point where it seemed like the book stopped being what it was originally intended or building to be, which was just like a linear, like we're going to adapt the game straight through. It sort of jumped around a little bit. So with that in mind, it didn't seem odd to me at all that the story would stop even though more things were happening. And because like that made sense to me as an ending. Like he began the series as Mega Man, Mega Man, the robot who kills other robots, and became Mega Man, the robot who saves, blah, blah, blah. Full circle. Proto Man, da-da-da. And I liked, like, Mr. X also felt definitive. Like, obviously it can go on. And as you said, you had more long-term plans because obviously he, like, showed up like games later, but to me that felt like a more cemented, like, yep, this is that, you know, this is that final statement. Everyone's sort of like the story, it's like a coming of, like, a, you know, Rockman is sort of a coming of age story. Everyone has sort of become themselves. Rock became Mega Man, and we now know what Mega Man means. Blues takes the name Proto Man. Xander sort of like regresses and, you know, sticks to, you know, he sort of becomes something worse, but ultimately sort of regresses back into himself. He learns the wrong lesson. So it felt like, again, if Mega Man came back, I would probably read it. I would, because it was a good comic. But I think I might have, I probably was one of the few people who read that, and I'm like, this is, like, it feels solidly definitive. And again, maybe that's just more how my brain works, because I've always cared about, you know, thematic touchy-feely blah, 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 than actually, like, going through the whole saga. Like, that was the point where I was like, it tied up well enough that it didn't feel like there needed to be more story. And Mr. X's appearance was a big part of that, even though I'm sure what it actually was look at all the stuff we can do later, where I read that, I'm like, wow, this is a good place to stop. Not in a bad way, but you know what I mean.
You're not wrong. That was the objective with issue 54 and 55, was to give that sense of finality that could easily be a springboard for more, but give you a sense of closure, to reach a kind of plateau that you can rest on until the series hopefully starts up again. And this ties into what we were discussing earlier about the world building, in that if I did my job right, and according to you, I did, you know, with Xander and all of the elements that are original surrounding him, since he is built on the ground rules I established from the canon, he fits in thematically, and you are able to make connections that aren't necessarily what I immediately intended, but are still within the theme of the world. So he feels more natural and part of the greater whole, which means I did my job right. If you don't agree with that, then, you know, I did my job wrong, but we're not talking to those people. We're talking to you.
The guy who paid money to be here.
Exactly. That's, no bias.
Let's ask my opinion on things. He paid money to hang out with us. Let's ask what he thinks. I like it. Well, there you go. No, but I mean, I joke, but it is a sincere opinion, obviously, or else I wouldn't be here. But yes, no, that's very enlightening. Thank you. It's I definitely enjoyed a lot of how you interpreted things and managed to make them work and blah blah blah. And I take it as the highest compliment of your ending that the loss of Mega Man didn't actually hurt that badly, because again, it felt like yeah. Just I was like yep, and I just went to sleep on my couch, because that's what I do.
It was a good point to just kind of, you know, not necessarily close a story out, but to, you know, close it for now, come back to it later.
I will say, though, because you brought up a point that often vexes me, even in conversations where I am polite, which do exist, shockingly, is that I think I do appreciate that you write on a level where if average Joe fan is reading it and wants, you know, just a solid adventure comic, that's what they get. But there's also just enough where my brain can turn on and I just make every random connection possible, and I cannot sound like I'm wrong. Because I appreciate that it's written at just the right level where it can work, you know, on multiple levels. I appreciate that.
I'm glad you enjoy.
I do enjoy. Also, we need more Breezy. I don't really care where. I don't even mean just in Sonic. Anywhere. I don't. If Mega Man comes back and Breezy's on TV, that's good. That's fine. Just anywhere.
Duly noted.
Just anywhere. Just and something about maybe here's a story. Maybe when Mega Man comes back, Proto Man is like living at their house, and he's like, Rock, you have to play this game. Rock's like, what is it? He said, it's called Sonic the Hedgehog, but colloquially it is known as Sonic 06, and it is the best. And then Proto Man and I are sitting playing it, and we're best friends.
Okay. So I've got the plot for Mega Man 56.
Yes. I knew it. Yes. I knew that's where the story was heading.
Well, you've been picking out all the themes I was going for, so I laid the groundwork. You figured out where I was going.
Thank you for humoring me.
Absolutely. Was there anything else you wanted to go over, or should we move on to other people's Q&A?
I think that might be it. I think I can't think of anything else. It's mostly just, honestly, I've just had fun talking. My favorite is when I say something and there's just like a gap of silence from you for like 3 seconds.
Just like giving a thoughtful answer.
You're just like regretting your decision immediately. Like I'll just say something stupid and just silence for like 3 seconds.
No.
It's between all the Discord delays and all that stuff. So yeah, it's cool.
Also, and I was just playing. I'm just kidding. But
editing is also a very fine tool that we can make use of. It's very nice.
Oh, yes, we'll sound brilliant by the end.
Yes, we'll make it sound great.
What you need to do is cut out all the gaps or that one part where I was taken out, but leave everything here. Just all the conversation about editing is still here.
Oh, don't worry. It'll all still be here. It's just it'll just go a lot faster.
You just need to like edit out everything I've ever referenced, but keep this conversation about the fact that I've referenced them. And then you can do a director's cut later.
For patrons only.
Yes.
Buying at $300 level.
This exclusive cut.
All right, Harlan, you stick around. We're going to do some Q&A, and then we're going to come back to you at the end of the show.
Okay. Sounds great.
And first up, from our Patreon priority Q&A queue, we have one from Michael B. Do you recall if Evan Stanley had to fill in for Tyson Hess for Sonic issue 265? I vaguely remember that she had to fill in for someone around that time, and I always thought that the Werehog Vision designs of Sally, Mighty, and the others were hers, not Hess's.
No, Sonic the Hedgehog 265's lead story was all Tyson Hess, with a backup by James Fry. You're thinking of Sonic the Hedgehog number 272, which was started by James Fry, and then Evan came in and wrapped up the latter half of that issue.
Ah, all right then. Well, I guess that answers that question, I think. This next question comes from Andrew F. How did you come up with the idea to have Jeffrey turn traitor and be an agent of Nagus?
This one came from when we were compiling notes for the Who's Who encyclopedia, which had been in development for a long time. Or was it when we were just doing some general house cleaning? I can't remember exactly what the impetus was, but basically I was rereading through all of the previous issues and kind of charting the course of the characters and seeing where they were and what they were doing and how they had gotten to where we were now at that point in time. And Jeffrey stood out because his motivations were all over the place. It made no sense what he was doing from one story arc to the other. He was doing things that were very blatantly malicious, or at least seemed like he was working against Elias. At other points, he was straight up working with the heroes. He was appearing out of nowhere, which I know was supposed to be something of the secret agent kind of things, but under certain writers, it didn't feel like secret agent. It just felt like, poof, he's there. And then what was the most telling, the thing that made me kind of go, aha, was in Sonic number 52, can't remember off the top of my head, but it's the issue where Nagus first is introduced in the comic continuity, that Jeffrey shows up oddly wearing a very Ixian looking cloak. And he shows up right before Nagus busts out of the zone of silence for no reason. There's no explanation why Nagus is able to break out here and now. So it's like, okay, if we look at Jeffrey, who has this very sketchy, shady, who knows what happened past, who has military ties to a military that fell when he was just a child, who's able to reappear out of just about nowhere, who seems to have his own agenda that's both helping but also undermining the Kingdom of Acorn, how does that all fit? If he were a sleeper agent for Nagus, who wasn't entirely sure if that was what he wanted to do, it was, in my mind, the best way to just kind of congeal it all together, give Jeffrey a clear and interesting plot, and really tie everything and push it together into the King Nagus arc that I was working on.
Mm.
Now, I know a lot of some people were not pleased with the idea of Jeffrey, who was more or less heroic, being a turncoat, which is kind of the point. It's the aha, you're supposed to go, oh no, my favorite. And there are people who would say that. There are people who legit like Jeffrey. But I think some folks who were reading it could see where I was going with him. It was a redemption arc.
Mm-hmm.
So you would still have your heroic Jeffrey, and he still did heroic things in the past. It's just within a different context. And it was, so long answer short, it was basically me trying to tie up loose ends and make a more cohesive narrative.
Did you sneak in a little jab at the fans of Jeffrey in there?
No.
Of course not.
No, I'm not fond of the character specifically because he feels like a James Bond insert. He doesn't really fit in Sonic. And him supposed to be so much older than Sally and Mac and Honor was kind of creepy. But, you know, the allure of the secret agent who knows a little more than you do and appears at just the right time to pull off the dashing move, that's cool. I got to give you that. True. Plus, you don't see a lot of skunks in the Sonic universe, and that was kind of neat, too.
Yeah. There were aspects of Jeffrey that I liked.
He's a polarizing character, and therefore I'm poking fun at the fact that there are people who hate Jeffrey versus those who love Jeffrey. I'm not making fun of the fans.
Okay. And finally, we have a question for me from Sam Cybercat.
Can I read it? You're going to answer it?
Yeah, go for it.
Yay, I get to read a question.
Wow.
This one comes from Sam Cybercat. I've been hearing a lot of people talk about the soundtrack to a recent game, Night in the Woods, lately. And I've been wondering if you've heard it too, and if so, what are your thoughts on it?
Actually, I went ahead and listened to it specifically because of this question. I was not familiar at all with the game or the soundtrack previously, but I am a fan of composer Alec Haloka. I believe that's how you say it. His previous works from Aquaria and Offspring Fling and Towerfall Ascension. So thanks for pointing it out to me and telling me to go check it out, basically, by asking this question. I have not listened to the whole thing, actually. I just kind of barely scratched the surface, but I am definitely enjoying what I hear so far. It has a little bit of that same vibe that Aquaria did, just a little less watery, I guess. It has some of the tracks for some reason have this kind of western deserty feel, which seems weird for a game called Night in the Woods. I don't know anything about the game at all, other than that it's a game. So we'll definitely have to go check it out. But from what I've heard of the soundtrack so far, I enjoy it, and I can see what the big deal is. So I've always been a fan of Alec's work since I've heard it in Aquaria. So, yeah. If you are someone who wants to go check it out too, you can head on over to infiniteammo.bandcamp.com. That's Alec's Bandcamp site. And you can find that soundtrack and a bunch of other ones there too. So, yeah, I recommend it. And I'm, you know, gotta get link plugs in here for soundtrack, for composers. Always need more love for video game composers.
They are the unsung heroes of the video game world.
Yes. Well, some of them are sung. Maybe some of them sing. Am I fired?
No, I need someone to produce the show.
Oh. Are you sure? I think you can do it.
Nope.
All right, let's head on into the standard Q&A. This one comes from Fallen Lantern 92. If characters lost after Genesis can't be used anymore, is there a way of recreating them but retaining their essence?
We've touched on this in some of the previous episodes, and technically, yes. I could probably just go wholesale and create a whole bunch of XPs and go that route. But I don't want to, because one, that feels lazy.
Uh-huh.
Two, they start off life as ripoffs. They aren't the original character. And I understand how fans of the original characters, some would be satisfied with having an XP. You know, it's just a new coat of paint. They can run with it. But to others, it's just, it lacks some imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like all the growth and direction I was heading with the original characters won't mean anything if it's just an XP, if it's just a placeholder. Because if we talked about Jeffrey earlier, let's have Jeffrey over here and Joffrey over there. You know, sure, we could have Joffrey the woodchuck in service to Naga's with the same backstory, more or less, but it's not the same because it's not Jeffrey. It doesn't mean it rings hollow. And if I'm going to go to all the effort to take a character and mold them just enough so that they are legally independent from the originating source, why not go ahead and just make something new? Yeah. Make something original. Go in a different direction and bring something that you might enjoy more. I am sorely tempted because there were a handful of characters that I really, really loved in the pre-reboot continuity. And I would love to find a way to bring their themes back over. But at the same time, that's a lot of hoops to jump through just to do something that won't really scratch that itch, that won't really bring that sense of closure or completion. So short answer, yes, but it's probably better not to.
Plus, you're probably, you know, treading into some legal territory issues.
Why potentially walk into the crosshairs when you can just do something new?
Right. Yeah. And I like the new characters, so there.
A lot of people do. I'm very happy with the amount of positive response the new continuity got.
Yes. All right. This next one is a pretty long one from Andrew D.
Yet again, guys. We really love the questions that you send in. They're probably the major drawing point of the show. But try to narrow them down to like a sentence or two. These block paragraphs are hard for us to go through.
That's cool. Andrew did send us some more questions that are a lot more succinct. So
it's sure, sure. Not picking on Andrew, just saying in general.
I know. I'm just saying, too, that he has some more questions that are a little bit more succinct. So good on him. And good on anybody who sends us questions, regardless of how long they are, but, you know, still. All right. After reading Sonic Mega Drive, I couldn't help but notice a few things. The intro mentioned the events of Sonic CD as having happened after Sonic 3 and Knuckles. Is that true for the comic timeline? Also, something to note is that Sonic stopped the Death Egg 3 times, once at the end of Sonic 2, once after launching from Launch Base Zone, and once after launching from Lava Reef Zone, but I'm assuming the introduction wanted to get to the point. It seems as though Metal Sonic will be in the next level, so does that mean that Sonic Mega Drive takes place after Sonic 4, as Metal Sonic was rescued from Little Planet in that game? Also, with Knuckles being duped by Eggman once again, would this be the second time or the third, as he was tricked by Eggman in Sonic Triple Trouble? I'm not sure which event happened first. And finally, at which point did you realize Sonic Mega Drive would be getting a sequel? It seems as though the first issue was written with a sequel in mind, as the ending seems to lead into the sequel.
Okay, dokie. So, number one, Sonic CD in the comic timeline actually takes place before Sonic 3 and Knuckles. I'm not sure where you got that, but their wording might have been a little obscure, because I don't want to bog down the story with, you know, all the tiny minutiae. That's all in my head. If I didn't convey it properly, my apologies. Sonic Mega Drive takes place after pretty much all of the classic adventures, so, you know, all of it is technically in the past, so just kind of roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing about Metal Sonic was, my understanding was that he was trashed in Sonic CD, wasn't recovered until Sonic 4, and in my mind, Sonic 4 was a bridging point between classic and modern. Come to find out that Sonic R is canon, and Metal Sonic is present in that. Therefore, Metal Sonic would have had to return from Little Planet and go back to Little Planet. So,
Sonic
this is
canon.
Where you start to realize there isn't a solid timeline continuity within the Sonic
there
lore.
There's no canon.
There's no streams canon. Of it here and there.
There's no canon. There's no canon,
there,
Ian.
Let me cling to the strings,
there's
Kyle.
There's no canon.
It's my job.
There's no, if Sonic R is part of the timeline, then there's no canon. There is none. Next, you're going to tell me Sonic the Fighters is canon.
No, decidedly not. We just brought Honey in.
Is it? It's not?
No.
Well, it's better
At least
than Sonic
I haven't
R.
Been told that it is. I don't know. I'm just going with what I'm told, all right?
Oh, man.
Anyway, the nice thing about that is, any classic story we tell, as long as it takes place before Metal Sonic gets dropped back on Little Planet, we're golden. So whether or not he gets hit by a rocket and lands back on there, or he falls through a Genesis portal, or Knuckles whops him a good one, who knows? It doesn't matter, because we're never going to pave that over anyway. That's Sega's thing. And it just means we can tell classic stories with Metal Sonic, which is a win for everybody.
True. So where in the timeline does Sonic Schoolhouse take place?
Anyway.
This is a serious question. This needs answering.
It is not canon. Don't even go there. I'm trying to answer these questions.
If Sonic R is canon, then everything's on the table.
Look, Kyle, you just need to feel the sunshine, all right?
It'll okay. Up your day. I love that song, I will admit. I love Sonic R's soundtrack. I love the soundtrack. But still, is the All-Stars Racing series canon?
I would consider it quasi-canon, since we did the one adaptation and it could fit well enough in what we have. I mean, now that we have opened up the Genesis portals, anything goes.
Well, yes. But, I mean, in Sega's mind.
I don't think so. I think it's its own brand, but I don't know for sure.
Okay.
It hasn't come up.
Okay. Well, if you do an adaptation of Sonic Schoolhouse, I will personally donate to our Patreon. I don't know what that means.
Whatever floats your boat. As for the sequel, we left it open-ended because, given what we had with Mega Drive, we assumed there would be enough support. If there hadn't been, like if it had tanked entirely, then nobody would have cared that we didn't follow up, because nobody would have read it. Instead, the pre-orders were so overwhelming that it was already put into second printing before the first printing even went out, I think.
That is true.
It went really, really fast. It had a huge response. It's like, okay, well, that obviously gave us the green light.
Yeah.
Let's move on ahead. So, you know, prepare for the worst, hope for the best.
Yes. I had a hard enough time finding it myself.
Part of it is crazy. Because people love classic Sonic. Part of it is because Tyson is freaking amazing.
Yeah.
It was a great time.
Yes. Yes, it is very good. And finally, this last question comes from Busalarian Theme.
I'm always impressed you're able to say that so easily.
Busalarian Theme. I don't know if I'm now saying it. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly.
Sounds correct to me.
But maybe I am. I haven't been told otherwise. Maybe it's just they're being nice and not correcting me. Please correct me if I pronounce your name wrong. Anyway, question is, have you ever played the Wolfenstein games?
I have not. I haven't played any, really, of the classic first-person shooters, unless you want to count, like, Jedi Knight, but that's really on the fringe.
About the more recent Wolfenstein games?
No, I haven't played any of the Wolfenstein series.
Okay.
Or any of the Quakes or any of the Dooms. Anything that promotes the stopping of Nazi influences, you know, got an A+ in my book, but I have not partaken in them. They are Nazis in Wolfenstein, right?
Correct.
Are they demons as well?
No. I don't think so.
Just straight up Nazis?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
Let's see. The first game, well, not the first game, but the 3D game, probably the most well-known one, Wolfenstein 3D. Has Hitler in a giant mech suit at the end of the game.
You can't get much more Nazi than that.
That's true. And, well, the same thing, well, a similar thing also happens at the end of Bionic Commando, so that's what people want to do. People just want to put Hitler in a giant robot and then blow him up. I don't know, it's fine. It's cool.
Well, probably because he was such a manlet that, you know, you could knock him out with a toothpick, so you need to give him something so it's more satisfying when you blow him up.
Yes, yes.
Not that blowing out by himself wouldn't be satisfying enough, but
I have played Wolfenstein 3D, the original. Why do I keep saying original? Because the original was like a side-scroller, I think, or maybe I'm thinking of Duke Nukem. Basically, it's the first first-person shooter, or amongst the first. Right. And that was my introduction to PC games, actually, was going over to one of my mother's friend's houses. And having them show me computer games, and Wolfenstein 3D was the first one they showed me. And I was like, I like 6, 7, maybe. It's like, yeah, this game's cool, right? You want to play? You want to play? I'm like, yeah, I want to play. I don't know what's going on, but this looks cool.
My first computer game was some Apple II thing.
Well, yeah, like I mean,
children's learners.
My first computer.
Find the Frog.
Okay, my first. Well, no, it actually wasn't my first computer game outside of school, because that would have been Lemmings. But it was amongst. Yeah, it was like amongst the first. It was definitely very early on in my computer gaming career. Something like that.
But it was before to wholesale slaughter in video games.
It was so. Before our family personally owned a computer. So, yes. Lemmings and Wolfenstein. So, yeah, wholesale slaughter.
Now, there's a crossover we need.
Well, Lemmings is dead, so I don't know when that's ever coming back. I'm surprised Wolfenstein is back. Wolfenstein being back amazes me enough. We could probably get a revival of Lemmings going. Oh, man. I remember playing Lemmings 2 on the Sega Genesis. That version sucked. I rented it because I was like, oh, Lemmings. I want to play Lemmings. I love Lemmings. And then I played it and I'm like, man, this game really needs a mouse. And I can hardly see because I was used to playing it on a computer screen, not on a TV, which was a zillion feet away from me. And it was our TV was janky and crappy anyway. It was dark. Couldn't see anything. So I'm like, man, I don't like this version at all. Maybe I'll play it again. Nah, I'll just play original Lemmings instead. It's better. Anyway, we're at the end of the show, I think.
And before we wrap everything up, we're going to give a big shout out to all the patrons who make this show possible week to week. Thank you very much to Daniel H., Zephyr Flame, Chris A., Damo, Duiz Dizden, John B., Sam Cybercat, S. Miles, Mike B., Fancy Fool, Connell T., Samuel P., Justin G., Jennifer R., Daniel L., Candy, for now, Andrew F., John M., S. Yovanovich 9X, Alex P., and James K. Thank you so much, guys.
Yes, thank you. You are the best around. Nothing's going to ever keep you down.
If you're looking for more stuff by me, head over to www.bumbleking.com or on Twitter at IanFlynnBKC. Keep up with all that I've got coming out, all that I'm working on, and all that I'm talking about.
And you can find me over at KyleJCRB on Twitter or at KNGI.org, where you can find archived MP3 episodes of this show and many, many others, including my regular weekly show, Game Fuel, which is all about video game music remixes.
You guys can't find me anywhere.
We found you right here. We found you on this podcast.
Darn it, Kyle, right. You beat me to the joke. Thank you again, Harlan, for joining us for this fine podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. And thank you for indulging my rambles.
Our pleasure.
Also, 6 is the best.
That's going to wrap us up for Bumblecast Episode 39. Join us next week for Bumblecast Gaming, and we'll see you in 2 weeks for Bumblecast Episode 40. Woo!
Hooray.
Meow.
I'm so sorry for my cat. It picked the worst time.
Well, Ian's got two cats. It's weird how I don't hear them very often.
Well,
if
last
ever.
Show, if you listen very, very carefully, you can hear one mew and then hit the mic stand.
Okay. Yeah, this is why I keep my animals in cages. And that I only have one animal, and it's a guinea pig, so of course it's going to be in a cage, but still.
I promise I won't be an asshole.
Well, I'm at $150, you get a little bit of leeway on just how asshole you want to be.
Let's be fair, Ian lets me be on the show every week, so...
Oh, stop it!
I'm still trying to figure Discord out.
Discord, that cord, whatever cord it is.
I don't know it. I don't know what's going on. Okay, here we go. Find a friend. Add a friend. I need friends. Ian, will you be my friend?
I'll be your friend, Kyle.
Wow. I feel so glad that someone's finally my friend. I finally have a friend.
Delirium through fatigue is hilarious.
Only one. Ah, shit.
Question comes from Sam Cybercat. I've been hearing a lot of people talk about the soundtrack to Soundtrack. Why I'm Australian. Good bloody
Field trick. I think that's Rika.
Okay.
Let me see how to pronounce
Rika. Rika.
Rika. Yeah, so Rika.
Rika.
I could just play the pronunciation sample every time you want to say the name.
Congratulations to Rika.
I think we're okay. I think we're okay. Good enough.
I don't know if that's going to be an easy bridge into the next episode because I don't remember what I said.
That's cool.
Not next episode, next segment.
I got it. I got the magic of editing. If I need if I need words from you, I will steal them from other episodes.
Crafty, all right.
I don't know if I'll actually do that, but I could.
If you need me to patch, I can patch.
Okay. Oh, that's friend suggestions. I don't want suggestions. I don't need any more friends.
Hi there, and thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you liked our show, be sure to hit the subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans on how to make the show even better. Also, rate and review our show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music composed by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com, available as a pay-what-you-want download.